Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, folks. It's Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. And here we are, first Saturday in December, 2016. Holy smokes, where is this year gone? I don't know. I do know I need 40-hour days, and I need 10-day weeks, and I need 24-month years. That's what I need. I'm sure you're all the same. Well, we got a big show for you today. First of all, I'm on the road on my annual December book signing tour that the publishers send me off hither and yither on. Kind of a annual tradition now. Thousands and thousands of books signed for readers and new readers, and meet lots of great people along the way and see lots of faces I've come to know over the years who are great readers of the Threads West series and the Land for Love and Money series. And I just got done signing Thursday and Friday, yesterday, at Warren Air Force Base in Cheyenne. And, you know, I'm just struck by the commitment and sacrifice that our service members make on our behalf. Defenders of Freedom, it is my honor to sign at military bases each year. Last year, a number of military bases, Tinker and Warren and several others. And this year, just because of what happened this year and all the fun stuff, you know, the trailer burned down, the dog died, and then she left me. My country woe song of the year. Just Warren this year, but we're going to correct that next year and do five or six bases as we normally do. But the Warren folks are just terrific. I just can't say enough about their hospitality and their setup and their advertising and their marketing of the signing. And for the, I believe, sixth time in a row, I sold them out of books, which, according to them, no author, big, small, or in between, has ever done other than I. So lots of people on that base reading reading Threads West, and lots of people in Cheyenne. And today I'm going to be signing at the Cheyenne Barnes & Noble. That's right, Saturday, December 3rd, 2016. My signing schedule, by the way, which is Helter Skelter, Denver and Aurora and South and Loveland and you name it, and then over to Idaho and Grand Junction toward the end of the month. I have the publishers posted it on Facebook, my page, the Threads West page, the Land for Love and Money page, and of course the On the Right Side Radio page. So if you want to know where I'm going to be and when, all those pages have the site. Our webmasters, I am told, are not yet fully back in control of the websites. You know, technology is such a pain in the butt, is it not? I mean, I switched from a Samsung. First of all, I had a flip phone, of course, up to a year ago. And then my 90-year-old mother shamed me into getting a smartphone, so to speak, much smarter than I came to learn. And I really wish to go back to the flip phone, to be honest with you. But anyway, I got talked into upgrading from a 5 to a 7. That was a traumatic experience over the last few days. Nothing worked. I had to go into Verizon in Cheyenne, and fortunately they knew what they were doing, so they got me kind of half set up. And the folks in Douglas where I got it, they were great, but I don't think they took me at my word when I said, look, I got 5 commands: on, off, attach, delete, and send. I don't want to learn any other commands. I don't want to use any other commands. I want to turn the damn thing on, and it's going to work. I don't think they quite understood the dinosaur mentality they were dealing with. Anyway, all that is corrected. The book signings are off and running. Warren was terrific. Thank you for the service. Thank you to the servicemen and women out there. Thanks for the great hospitality. Looking forward to seeing a number of you today at Cheyenne Barnes & Noble, and then over the course of the month in Denver, Loveland, Aurora, Twin Falls, Idaho Falls, you name it, in Grand Junction. Now, enough of the fun stuff and the holiday stuff and et cetera. Got a big show again for you this week. And, you know, I got to tell you, I have a bad feeling about this recount deal that's going on, supposedly through Jill Stein and supposedly through donations from millions of little worried Democrats and progressives around the country. It's such a grassroots thing. Make me puke. First of all, what progressives do best and do always and do without fail is lie. That's what they do. They lie. That is the first rule in their Saul Alinsky Foul, the Handbook for Radical Rules of Rules. Lie. Lie, lie, lie. Lying liars. So I have this uneasy feeling about this recount thing, and I'm going to go over it in detail. I'm going to pull together some dots for you that I don't think have been pulled together by anybody else in the press as to what I think is really going on here. And once again, listening to many of the talking heads, I don't think they get it. And I don't think they understand exactly what could come down here and what the Democrats, I use the word Democrats, the progressives, are trying to get done, who's behind it. I just don't think they get it. Anyway, I'm going to try and lay it out for you. I'm going to give you the dots. As always, you can connect and you are one smart audience. We're going to talk a little bit about Barack Hussein Obama tonight, too. Because, you know, once again, progressives are lying liars, and he's the king of the lying liars. Hillary is, of course, the queen. Everybody else are just loyal princes and princesses. And Barack Obama is doing everything he can to sabotage the transition to a Trump presidency and the deletion, literally, the delete key, hit delete, of his 8-year treasonous and, you know, purposely misguided policies and quote-unquote legacy. And he's doing everything he can to sabotage this deal. While on the other side of his lying little lips, he's talking about how his team is cooperating and Trump is going to be this and Trump is going to be that. We're going to go over a little bit of that tonight. I mean, really, it's almost getting to the point of boring because it's so predictable. I mean, that's what these people are. That's who they are. That's what they do. You can count on it. You can count on it like the sun rising tomorrow morning. And then we're going to go over this recount thing. By the way, part of what Barack Obama, what Barry Baby is globalist. And that's what Hillary is, a globalist. And you know, the whole cobble of leaderships in the Western world and in some third world countries are globalists. And that's what horrifies them about Trump's election and the Brexit vote. And I've warned you about this, you go back into the shows 4, 5, 6 months ago, the next big blow to the movement for globalism is going to be Italy's vote on Sunday, our Sunday, their Monday, on Sunday, on constitutional reforms. And they're calling it Quiddily. You know, they have all these great names, Brexit, now it's Quiddily. Italy, really, depending upon how this vote goes, if they vote down these constitutional reforms that the globalist elites who run Italy have put on the ballot, so to speak, they are in effect voting to leave the European Union. And I think you will see quite a bit of tumult. And I also think you will see a no vote. That's right. I think Quiddly is going to happen just like Brexit and Trump happened. And then you may see a Francit, you know, a France exit. Who knows what's going to be happening? But I can tell you that the groundswell of nationalist populism, by the way, I'm pretty sure I'm the first one to ever coin that phrase. I can't be 100% positive, but I coined it quite some time ago in trying to describe what Trump was. And long before the Brexit vote, long obviously before the Quiddly vote, which is not going to be until Sunday. And now I'm beginning to see those exact words in a bunch of mainstream media. Nationalists, some of them call it national populist, others call it populist nationalism. Bottom line is, I think the light bulbs are blinking out there in media land. I think they finally get it, what's going on. And you know, Trump, in his little victory tour, which by the way, I think he's conducted with great alacrity and terrific poise, and just the right amount of chest thumping without gloating. I think he's done a terrific job. But in his latest deal in Cincinnati, he pounded on globalism. He basically said, you know, forget this global economy. We want an American economy. Forget this globalism. We want nationalism. You know, forget this borderless world. We want national sovereignty with stronger than hell borders. I mean, and he went on and on. The bottom line is that this is a groundswell around the planet right now. And globalists like Barry and Pillory and Nancy Pelosi, who is incredibly elected again as the House Minority Leader, unbelievable. And that whole cobble, which is quite far-reaching now, these people are globalists, and that's what worries them about Trump. I mean, Obama has other worries, too, and that's his personal legacy and all that crap, but it all ties into globalism. And I'm going to go over a really interesting... In Obama's case, it's also tinged because he is, at best, folks, I mean, I'm bending over backwards to give him the benefit of the doubt. At best, he is a Muslim sympathizer. At best. And I'm going to give you a litany of things which tie into his globalism feelings, his conviction that the Western colonial powers and white people are to blame for all the ills on the planet Earth, and his allegiance, undying allegiance to globalism, reparations, retribution. That's who this guy is. That's who progressives are. And there was a new UN General Secretary voted in here just a week ago. He, of all places, he's the former premier, president, who cares what, of Portugal. Now, remember, Portugal is one of the pigs countries. I've talked about this many times. You new listeners, if you type P-I-G-S in the search bar on the website, you'll get up a whole bunch of articles. I mean, I was talking about the pigs, Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain, and how they were going to drag the European Union down. Years and years ago, and here we are. Here we are. Spain's bank could literally crater all the friggin' banks, the whole entire banking system of the EU. Italy's banks are not much better, 18% default rate on notes, and I can go on and on. All those banks, by the way, are in negative interest rate territory. In other words, they are paying people to borrow money. And savers, people who have a savings account, are paying the bank to hold the money. That's how upside down the European Union is with this globalism, globalistic thought. Part of what really taints Barry's globalistic attitude is his Muslim sympathies. I'm going to read you a list. It's an amazing list of things he has said or done over the last 8 years. And you, dear listeners, you can just listen to these things. And by the way, you libs who listen to this, you can Google up every one of these quotes. Google them up for yourself. None of this is made up. You will see the exact time, date, place, and to whom he said what about to whom concerning Islam, Muslims, and himself relative to those two, shall we say, wayward ideologies. And then we're going to go into this UN deal, because the UN, the new UN Secretary General, former premier, president, whatever, of Portugal, which is absolutely, Portugal's like, you know, Portugal is like a toad with all four legs in the air under a hot sun on Death Valley, okay? But this is the guy who got elected to be UN General Secretary. He is an avowed socialist, which is why Portugal is like a dead toad in the sun. And he is an avowed globalist. And wait till you hear what he told other world leaders, his kind of acceptance speech for being UN General Secretary. Man, you're just going to puke. But you will understand more about globalism and the forces of the globalists, which are amassed against the rise of nationalist populism, as indicated by Trump and Brexit and Quiddly, etc., and the recent vote in France, which I went over last week on the show. The gentleman who's leading now in the French elections is the guy who's rolling back socialism, making the work week longer, cutting down on retirement. I mean, just the opposite of where France and socialism has been going. It is a massive worldwide movement, and the globalists are nervous as hell, which is going to lead me to the last segment of this show, which is this recount nonsense, supposedly by Jill Stein, supposedly financed by all these little people out there in America land, who's just, you know, they just want to have an election system that works and that's clean and there's no fraud. Oh my, I mean, does it make you want to puke or not? But I'm going to give you a whole bunch of dots in this thing, because I have an easy feeling about it. You know, there's a disturbance in the force that I don't like about this whole recount deal, and the rather nonchalant, at least on the surface, attitude that the Republicans and conservatives, and most of the media, by the way, are granting this recount effort in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Anyway, I think you'll find these details, which you have not heard, certainly not in one place, and probably in many cases have not heard at all, anywhere else. And we'll see if you come to the same conclusion that I do as to what they are really trying to do, albeit drawing to an outside straight. And last but not least, I'm going to finish up the show, if we have time. And I've been really lousy the last three or four shows, staying within my allotted time. I have the AM stations who I think want to, well, the nice guys want to neuter me. The guys who are not so nice probably want to just hang me. Oh, well. I just can't control the blab, I guess. But we're going to talk about, if we have time, in the very last segment, something which, once again, our press hasn't brought to your attention whatsoever. Isn't that a surprise? And this is about a bunch of really deadly nuclear material. In fact, iridium-192, right, caused death in several hours of exposure to humans, that has been stolen from an Iranian nuclear plant. In fact, in the first part of November, a month ago. And do you know where I got this news? Because I get hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of newsletters, articles, you name it, from all sorts of sources around the planet. Israeli news, Arutz Shiva. That is IsraelInternational.com. The American press and the Western European presses haven't mentioned a word about this. Amazing. But it is, I think, very dangerous. And I will tell you why if we get to that. If not, we will go over it next week. By the way, since I know I'll be running out of time at the end of the show, next week we're going to be talking about China also. I'm putting together some stuff. Trump had a really interesting set of phone calls with foreign leaders, one of them with the president of Taiwan. Taiwan and China. China views Taiwan as a wayward province, and Taiwan views itself as an independent state. And with the, shall we say, possible abrasion with China through Trump economic policies, and the definite already existing abrasion with China over the South China Sea and then building islands, etc., this is very, very interesting. And we're going to talk about some of the potential effects next week relative to American, you know, Sino-American relations and how Russia might fit into that triumvirate, will you, of powers. But that will be next week. Now, I've rambled on here for some time. Let's get started with the show, shall we? First of all, Obama. Barry, baby. I mean, this guy, you can just set your clock by his lies. So Barry, baby, has given us all this lip service about what, you know, all the wonderful things he's going to do to make life wonderful for Donald Trump and yada, yada, yada. Well, in the meantime, just so you know, because I promised you I'd bring this to your attention every week, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. Listen to the last two shows. You'll get a list of things that Obama's been doing to try and cement his legacy, make it more difficult to dismantle, and undermine the transition to Trump. Okay, so 100 new regulations this week alone, with another 100 in preparation for him to sign. These are all executive order regulations. I mean, all they do is just create chaos and waste of time and money, American taxpayer money, waste of time by a new administration that needs to hit the ground running to undo them. So he will have passed 800, give or take, new regulations by executive fiat since the November 8th election on the day that he leaves office. Oh my, what a happy day that'll be, which is January 20th. In addition, we find out now that the Iranian nuclear deal, which, by the way, we still don't have the whole story on, but we have found out much relative to the misrepresentation by both statement and omission by Kerry, Obama, and crew. We now found out that Obama is fast-tracking licenses for American businesses to set up shop in Iran. And the reason he's doing this is to make the Iranian deal much more complicated to unravel and to create pressure points within America itself against Trump's promise to basically rip up the deal and renegotiate it. It is just unbelievable. And given my last segment, if we have time to reach it, this nuclear material, which, by the way, isn't even supposed to exist under the agreement, this nuclear material being stolen from an Iranian power plant, you know, people don't steal nuclear material that can kill a human with several hours of exposure unless they have a reason to do it. Wouldn't you agree? They're not like, you know, this isn't like breaking into a jewelry store and getting a diamond or two to fence, sell on the black market, give to your sweetheart, or put it under your pillow. It's not the same. In addition to these two wonderful acts or whatevers, Barry Obama. I want you to think about this. Barry Obama undermined Trump's proclaimed attitude and plans for Cuba with the most tepid, in fact, I wouldn't call it tepid, I would say complimentary eulogy for Fidel Castro, a murderer, a dictator, a fascist. Remember, everybody's calling Trump a fascist? Well, Fidel Castro is a fascist. Fascism, if you listen to my show from last week, is a product of the left. Totalitarianism is a product of the right. So, you know, oh my. And I want to put this in perspective for you. So Ben Rhodes, who is the guy who lied through his teeth for 8 years under Barry, 25-year-old, you know, had a degree in friggin' finger painting, wound up as drafted the Benghazi talking points for Susan Rice with the video and all that stuff. He is up to his eyeballs in lies, and admitted it. I went over this with you in the show about 4 or 5 weeks ago. Admitted it on the record and laughed at the American people and how stupid they were. I mean, Ben Rhodes, great. So Ben Rhodes and one other Obamatron administration progressive moron, they're being sent to Castro's quote-unquote funeral. Castro was actually cremated, so whatever kind of service it is. They're being sent to Castro's funeral. I want you to know that in 2013, when Margaret Thatcher died, that's Margaret Thatcher from England, our closest ally on the planet, our Anglo brethren across the sea, the country that we stood shoulder to shoulder with, in several world wars to beat back Nazi and British and Japanese imperial aggression and the forces of communism under Stalin and Lenin and later on Khrushchev. That Britain, Margaret Thatcher, one of its greatest prime ministers ever, probably second only to Churchill, he didn't send a single person, not one American representative of America or the American government was dispatched by Barry and his progressive deplorables to Margaret Thatcher's funeral, but they're sending two of their quote-unquote top deplorables to Castro's deal. Doesn't that kind of tell you everything you need to know, folks? Doesn't it? Huh? You bet. And I will continue to pound the drum. We are now down to 50 or so days to the inauguration on January 20th. We are down to, December 4th, 15 days to the Electoral College, which we're going to be talking about here in a few minutes. And this is a very dangerous 50 days. It's dangerous with China. It's dangerous with Russia. It's dangerous with ISIS. It's dangerous on some level of terrorism, given what this theft of nuclear material in Iran and the fact they have never recovered the 80 pounds of nuclear material taken by ISIS from Mosul University. When ISIS, who shouldn't have even existed, you know, had Barry done what he should have done as president of the United States in looking after the security and welfare of his own people and his own nation above all others, this is worrisome. Worrisome. So I'm going to repeat, for the next 50 days, danger, Will Robertson, danger. On many levels. I mean, America will be its most vulnerable in many, 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 many years, maybe decades, over the next 50 days. Let's just keep our fingers crossed that all goes well. That's all I can say. But, all right. So, you libs out there who have written me scathing emails about my accusation of Barry being a, at best, Muslim sympathizer, I've put together a little list for you. So here we go. And by the way, You know the old kind of Wyoming colloquialism, the old country colloquialism? I don't think Wyoming has the dibs on it. You know, if you walk like a duck and you quack like a duck and you have feathers like a duck and you eat like a duck and you lay eggs like a duck, there's a really high probability that you're a duck. Keep that in mind, you libs, as I go through this little list for you. Okay, let's get started. For all you folks out there who doubt Obama's Muslim sympathies and how it colors his worldview and his globalism drive. And by the way, this all ties into my last segment, which is the Electoral College. Obama was the only major world leader who didn't go to France to show solidarity with 40-plus other Western and world leaders against the Muslim terrorists after the terrorism rampage a year and a half ago. The only one. Barry Obama spoke these words at an Islamic dinner in the late 1990s. Quote, "I am one of you," unquote. Barry Obama gave $100 million of U.S. taxpayer funds to foreign Muslim organizations to rebuild foreign mosques. He's also done the same thing domestically. I did a whole show on it. You can put it in the search bar. And hid the money through the Department of Agriculture in the case of the domestic distributions to build and rehab and expand mosques. Barry Obama wrote in his own book, in his own words, that if the political winds blow ill, quote, quote, "I will stand with the Muslims," unquote. Barry Obama assured the foreign minister of Egypt when the whole turmoil was going on with Mubarak and his buddies, the Muslim Brotherhood, were taking power, quote, "I am a Muslim," unquote. These are his words, you libs who are listening, his words. It was Barry Obama who bowed. There's no question about it. You can dial up the, please dial up the photographs and tell me. I mean, either he has his appendix burst and he was clutching his stomach and lowering his head to the ground, or he was bowing to the King of Saudi Arabia. Quote, quote, "God damn America," unquote. Those are the famous words and a whole bunch of others of Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who, although not Muslim, is close friends with Louis Farrakhan, who is a radical Islamist and a racist. And Barry and Michelle sat in his pew for 20 years listening to his anti-American, in some ways anti-Christian, which is kind of ironic for a pastor, rhetoric. And it was Barry, folks, who exempted, and you can check this out. I've gotten, you know, people have argued with me on this. Boy, it's in the law. Fortunately, Obamacare isn't going to exist much longer, so it doesn't matter. But he exempted Muslims from the penalties under Obamacare that everybody else in the United States has to pay. Just Muslims. Quote, "Endowed by our Creator," unquote. That happens to be some of the key words in the Declaration of Independence. When Barry recited the Declaration of Independence, he omitted those words, specifically, "endowed by our Creator." He mocked the Bible and Christ's Sermon on the Mount, instead referring to the Holy Quran in several speeches. Please, Google it up. If you go to his 2009 Cairo speech, you can make up your own mind. You can read the entire text of it. Denigrating America in the eyes of the Muslim world. Specifically, in the eyes of the Muslim world. What you didn't know, probably, is that his administration threw all their weight and might behind the Muslim organizations which wanted to build the Ground Zero Victory Mosque, which would have overlooked, literally, the crater of the World Trade Center. I don't know if you know this, but at one point, I believe it was 5 years ago, he declined to attend the National Prayer Breakfast, but a week later hosted an Islamic prayer breakfast at the White House. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact year. You can Google it up, find out for yourself. Now, this is a rumor, and I have not... In fact, I'm not even going to go over it. I'm just going to go with the straight facts. So let's go to the next item here. It was Barry who appointed Muslim Brotherhood people to high places, and I've done shows on this, with the names. The whole nine yards. Just dial it up in my search bar. Muslim Brotherhood. Okay? Muslims in security positions. I've given you the names, the dates, the whole nine yards. It's Barry Obama who directed that. And it was Barry Obama who appointed Islamists to Homeland Security. It's Barry Obama who said that NASA's, quote, foremost mission, unquote, was not going to the Mars, not going to the moon, not space travel, space exploration, or the advancement of science. No, it was an outreach to the Muslim communities. That was their foremost mission. You are the first president, he was the first president, not to give a Christmas greeting from the White House. The first president. It's amazing. 240 years. Barry Obama and his administration did everything in their power quite successfully to slow down and curtail the military tribunal hearings of the terrorists in Guantanamo. That's not well known, but it is true. At the same time, as you well know, through Eric Holder and others who were his mouthpieces, he wanted to move all those Guantanamo, those Gitmo detainees. Not only did he want to close Gitmo, he wanted to move those Gitmo detainees to the United States and spend tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, on trying them and incarcerating them here, assuming they were convicted. It was Barry Obama, folks, and his administration who called Fort Hood workplace violence and refused to condemn Major Hassan, the Fort Hood killer, as an Islamic terrorist. You're familiar with numerous times they have never used the word radical Islamic terror or radical jihad. That you know for sure. But you could think of numerous times from San Bernardino, anywhere you want to go, Chattanooga, the whole nine yards, where they have refused to accept the act of terror, radical Islamic terror, as an act of radical Islamic terror, instead of trying to pawn it off on everything in the world like they did Fort Hood, Fort Hood and the workplace violence. It was Barry Obama who funneled $900 million in United States taxpayer money to Hamas. In a speech in India, a little bit more than a year ago, he was questioned after the speech by the press over there. He absolutely refused to discuss radical global jihadists. You know, how ISIS has spread to all these countries. He profusely praised Islam as a religion of peace. This is in India. That's a country that's 82% Hindu and the victim of numerous Islamic terrorist assaults. Yeah. He has never spoken out concerning the horrific executions of women and children and men and the enslavement of women and children by Muslims, radical Muslims, Muslims who promote and thoroughly follow and believe in the doctrines of Sharia law. But he did submit Arizona to the United Nations for investigation of hypothetical human rights abuses. Unbelievable. It was Barry Obama, folks, who ordered the United States Postal Service to honor Muslim holidays with a new commemorative stamp. Google it up. It was Barry Obama who directed our British embassy, that is our embassy in the United Kingdom, to conduct outreach to help, quote, empower, unquote, the British Muslim community. It is Barry Obama, through his education secretary and the Department of Justice, thank you, Loretta and Eric, who funded, with United States taxpayer dollars, Mandatory. I've published articles on this under women. That's where I put all the education articles. So you gals who, you know, basically run your houses and your kids can see what the hell is going on at schools and universities that you are sending your children to. But it was Barry Obama through his administration who funded with United States taxpayer dollars mandatory Arabic language and culture studies in grammar schools all across the country. It's Barry Obama does not wear jewelry. That is a Muslim custom. No form of jewelry during Ramadan. Barry Obama is the one who decided through his minions at the White House, who, of course, they were the faces behind his decision, to not support the current anti-jihadist government of Egypt, a government that was installed when 36 million Egyptians took to the street to oust his buddies, the Muslim Brotherhood, whose rise to power he did support when Mubarak was deposed. And it's Barry who appointed as his chief advisor Valerie Jarrett, I've talked about her a lot, an Iranian born in Tehran, Iran, who is a member, folks, of the Muslim Sisterhood, which is an offshoot, kind of the female version of the Muslim Brotherhood. And it was Barry Obama who said quite clearly, Google it up, that the United States is not a Christian nation. And it is Barry Obama who, in his own book, said that the Muslim call to evening worship is the most beautiful sound on earth. I guess the only thing I have to say is quack, quack, quack. Now, take this globalism, extend it to the new United States. The new Secretary General of the United Nations, and what he told a room full of European Union bureaucrats just this last Wednesday, quote, migration is not the problem but the solution, unquote. This was in Lisbon, by the way, at the Vision Europe Summit. The guy's name is Antonio Guterres. Like I said, He's the premier of the failed state of Portugal. He thinks that all the bureaucrats around the world need to sell to their populations borderless states and acceptance of all sorts of refugees and migration, including particularly Muslim immigration, refugee movement, whatever you want to term it. He said, quote, every European Union nation must be forced, he used the word forced, to share the burden of mass migration. Share the burden of mass migration. And then, even though he had used the word burden, telling everybody that they have to give residence to large numbers of alien folks, quote, he says, quote, we must convince Europeans that migration is inevitable and that it is the multi-ethnic societies, which are multicultural and multi-religious, who are building wealth, unquote. You guys, any of you folks who have not listened to my show on globalism, multicultural, I gave you a bunch of buzzwords. They're all in that sentence and the other things that he said. This is how the globalists think. This is what their aim is. This is why they're so upset over Trump, and this is why this recount stuff is going on and has me worried, which we're going to get to next. Here's another quote from this socialist from the failed state of Portugal who is now running the United Nations. Quote, not convinced that it will be easy, given the state of public opinion, that is, hoodwinking the masses that migration and dilution of their culture, of their language, and of their economies, and of their religions. Convincing them that that is a good thing is not going to be easy. Really? Gee, you think? And what he asked the people in that room, that meeting, to do was to put tolerance and reason at the hearts of their decision-making and their pitch to people. You know, not practicality, not logistics, not security, but tolerance and reason. And he urged all the folks to sell to their constituents the priority of values, and that values were more important than respecting their voters' rights. Quote, when elected officials hesitate to choose between values in the next election, I would advise them to choose values. If they go for short-term electoral gain, they will lose both, because there will always come a time when they lose an election. At that point, it becomes very hard to recover the values that they have abandoned. Gee, let's see, you have a country of 50 million, and you got 10 million unassimilated, unvetted refugees that fled into it. How difficult it is to reverse those values, sir? Of course, I'm just a hayseed from Wyoming. What the hell do I know? As some backdrop to this, if you go to data from all the different European countries, non-European migrants, folks, and we already know this, are a net cost to national treasuries, a net cost. In the Netherlands, just as one example, 65% of non-European migrants who arrived in the 1990s, we're talking two decades ago, are still living on welfare. 65% are still on welfare after 20 years. Pretty amazing. What Trump represents, what Brexit represents, what Quiddly represents, what the recent surge in the nationalist populist candidate in France represents, is a rejection of this crap I just read to you, of the crap that I gave you the litany of relative to Barry, of the stuff you see with your own two eyes, of the corruption of the media, of the corruption of the government and big business. And you need to understand that not only is there power and ideology at play, there's trillions upon trillions upon trillions of dollars at stake. You know, Hillary Clinton's campaign did not raise and spend several billion dollars, whatever it was, because there isn't a hell of a lot of money on the line, folks. People don't give campaigns 10, 20, 30, whatever million-dollar checks unless there's something to gain. This is not philanthropy. This is not charitable giving. This is giving with a purpose. Giving with a purpose. And given the amount of money which is at risk, the amount of power which is at risk, the ideology which is at risk, globalism itself at risk, it is no wonder that Jill Stein, as the face of Hillary Clinton, funded by George Soros, not a bunch of little Americans as they would like to have us believe, is trying to get these recounts going in these three states. Let me give you a little background. Trump won Wisconsin by, and I'm going to round numbers, 22,000 votes. He had 22,000 votes more than Hillary. Jill Stein got 31,000 votes in Wisconsin. In other words, Jill Stein, who drew virtually all of her votes from Hillary, virtually all, I bet you 99.99999%, Jill Stein cost Hillary Wisconsin. I mean, Trump did a brilliant campaign and all that kind of stuff, but the bottom line is Jill Stein cost her Wisconsin. And the same is true in Michigan. I'm not going to go into all the numbers. Trump won Michigan by 10,107 votes. Stein got like 25 or 30,000 votes, somewhere in that neighborhood. And that was the difference in Michigan. And in Pennsylvania, and there's conflicting numbers, by the way. Some people say that Trump won by 70. Others say 48. Why don't we just say 50,000 votes? I mean, you know, I'm not sure we'll ever really know. But he won by about 50,000 votes. And guess what? Stein got like 40 or 45,000 votes. So she was very close to Hillary's margin of loss in that state also. Now, Stein raised about $3.5 million in her campaign for president. So far, she is rumored to have raised $7 million in about 10 days, maybe 2 weeks, for this recount effort. And the money is still pouring in. And although the Stein folks say that the money is coming from lots and lots and lots of little donors, there's been studies by folks who know about this stuff done on the money raising. And it appears that, kind of like clockwork, her funds are coming in at $160,000 an hour. I mean, give or take a few pennies, hour after hour, the contributions are $160,000. And you know what? The contributions, even though these are all supposed to be American donors and all little people, stay constant, as does visitation to her website through the wee hours of the night and morning. In other words, at noon on a Monday, she's getting $160,000 and umpty-ump website visits. And at 3 in the morning on Tuesday, she's getting the same amount of website visits and the same $160,000. Wow. You know, I think that's quite a coincidence. Because as we all know, and as I know just from selling books just on Amazon, web traffic goes way down at night. And even further down between the hours of 1 a.m. and 4 a.m. in the morning. That is, let's face it, the kind of the slow time for web traffic. But not so for Jill Stein's website or her fundraising. Where could this money be coming from? I wonder. Let's take a look at some more little facts, which the media hasn't sought to either find out and certainly hasn't sought to share with you. First of all, Jill Stein cannot file. She missed her deadline to file in Pennsylvania. That means she has to go to court, and she has to prove prima facie, not beyond a reasonable doubt. Not, you know, it's not that high a standard, but there's still a pretty high standard. She has to prove that there is a good probability of voter fraud and tampering in Pennsylvania. She has to go to court and do that since she missed the deadline. Now, whether or not she gets that done, we don't know. She has filed the court appeal. And, by the way, her estimates for these recounts, which was about $6 million in these three states, not even going to be close, folks. Wisconsin alone is going to be about $3.9 million plus legal fees. Because in Wisconsin, she wanted to do a hand vote. I'll tell you why that's important here in just a moment. And I'll tell you why her going to court in Pennsylvania is important in just a moment. I think it'll all tie in when I give you these dots and what the real game plan is here. So when Wisconsin refused to do a hand vote, which takes far longer, key point, keep that in mind, far longer than doing a, you know, kind of partial by hand, partial automated recount, depending upon which county wants to do what, Stein goes to court in Wisconsin to try and force a hand recount of all the ballots. I mean, we're talking about 2.5 million ballots. 2.5 million ballots. A judge in Dane County turned her down. Now, some of the counties in Wisconsin are going to be hand counting anyway on the recounts, the smaller counties. It's just easier for them. But this saved a bunch of time. Now, why would... Remember that the Electoral College is December 19th. That's when the vote is taken. And basically, to get that vote going, to have electors in place, which cannot be put in place until a state's vote is certified, that is, all done, recounts over, etc., it all has to be done by December 12th or 13th. Otherwise, it's possible that states would not have a certified vote and therefore could not designate and send electors to the Electoral College to vote. Never mind the fact that that would deprive all the citizens of their state, in the case of Wisconsin, 2.5 million people who voted, any representation in this foundational constitutional selection of a president called the Electoral College. Now, on one hand, Stein says she's doing all this because she wants to make sure there's election process integrity and that every vote counts and blah, blah, blah. But on the other hand, once again, progressives lie. On the other hand, she's taking steps which would preclude 2.5 million people, I'm just using Wisconsin as an example, of having any say in the selection of a president because their vote is not certified, and they have no electors at the Electoral College. The same with Pennsylvania, millions more voters. And the same with Michigan, even millions more voters. So the woman who says she wants every vote to count is willing to disenfranchise completely 10 to 15 million voters in three states who run the very real risk if she delays this process by filing lawsuits and demanding hand counts and all the crap she's doing. The very real process of having no representation whatsoever in the Electoral College. 15 million votes thrown out the window. But she's concerned about each and every vote, folks. That's why she's doing this, you bet. Now, what happens with the lawsuit in Pennsylvania, whether the Pennsylvania courts will allow her to move forward, is unknown. In Michigan, the Attorney General of Michigan has taken some steps which could very well block any recount in Michigan. One of the things that Stein likes to say is that there's computer experts. They're always unnamed. There's no names. In any article I've read from any site, from any source, whether left, right, or in the middle, mainstream or behind the curtain, no names are mentioned. It's just this amorphous, anonymous group of computer experts that say there's anomalies in the statistics. It could have happened, but we have no proof. Look, bottom line, this is all a bunch of crap. If there's voter fraud discovered, I guarantee you it's on the Democratic side, not the Republican side. To put this in perspective, in Wisconsin, there was a recount, I believe it was in 2011. It was for a state position. Let me see if I can find that information. I got stuff all over my desk here. Well, unfortunately, I can't find it just offhand, but let me put it this way. The two people that were running, first of all, the recount was called by the Democrat. She wanted the recount, and 7,000 votes and change separated these two candidates out of several million votes cast in Wisconsin. This is 2011. They recounted the entire state. They recounted it by hand. I mean, the most meticulous, painstaking, long-term, expensive process you could imagine. And in the end, there was like 310 votes or 311 votes that switched. 311 votes out of 2.5 million. And that's in a race that was, the two candidates were 7,000 votes apart, not, as in the case of Trump, 22,000 votes apart. So it seems pretty clear. Oh, and one other thing. Stein is jumping up and down on this possible tampering, jacking around with hacking into voter machines by Russians or unnamed people with no proof. Except Michigan, folks, uses paper ballots. Oh, my God. What are we going to do about that? How do you hack into a paper ballot? Tell me that. That, by the way, is one of the things that the Michigan AG is using to thwart any recount in Michigan, who just got done counting the votes like 5 days ago and certified Trump the winner, just so you know. You know, all these things, on one hand, Stein says something. On the other hand, logics and her actions say something else. And she says something about her funding, but that does not match what's really happening on her website, or the amount of money that's being raised, or the pattern, shall we say, of that money appearing. Anyway, the Clinton campaign, of course, through their attorney, Mark Elias, E-L-I-A-S, quote, he says, quote, "The Clinton team has not uncovered any actionable evidence of hacking or outside attempts to alter the voting technology. Even Obama, who I'm sure is working behind the scenes to keep the recount going, at least publicly, is stating that, quote, Trump won the election free and fair from a cybersecurity perspective, unquote. Yet Stein continues, and Hillary's attorneys are present, and Obama's off doing his little jig, and we have the Secretary General, the new Secretary of the United Nations, talking about globalism and immigration, which, of course, is a Trump thing. All these things make me nervous, shall we say, because it tells me that something else is afoot. There is mischief afoot. Dark clouds indeed do boil on the horizon. Now, riddle me this, Batman. What do the progressives have to gain? And I've heard all sorts of theories. I mean, I've heard theories about And you've probably seen them on TV. Well, they just want to embarrass Donald Trump. Well, she just wants to put together a network of small donors for use in the future by the Green Party. Well, she just wants the notoriety and public opinion. Well, this, well, that. I mean, all this nonsense. And I've heard the pundits say, well, it doesn't matter because even if you lost two of the states, and which would never happen, you still have one of the states and he has 270 votes and yada, yada, yada. You know what, folks? It never pays to underestimate your enemy. I think we have seen that with the Japanese in 1941. The Wehrmacht and the Panzer divisions of 1939 and 1940, Hitler and Poland. We have certainly seen it in the rise of ISIS. It never pays to underestimate your enemies. So in the case of the progressives and the recount, we have the motive, money, power, ideology. We have the means, Jill Stein as the face, George Soros financing the whole thing behind the scenes through bot contributions. I have articles on the site here. You can read them under Scandal and Constitution. Please do. So we have motive and we have means. Now, what do we have for desired results? Let me tell you what I think we have. This is a very, very, very gray area of the Constitution. I mean, we've just never been here before. And I'm not sure that many of the pundits understand what I believe the Constitution requires. Because I have heard pundits talk about, well, you know, even if Trump lost this and lost that and lost this, it would go to the House of Representatives and they'd vote Trump in and that would be fine. And the real reason they're doing this is so that they can say that Trump didn't win the popular vote and he didn't win the electoral vote and then undermine Trump. Listen, all that may be true, but from the progressive standpoint, I think it's icing on the cake. It's kind of like they have a win-win thing going. One win is a little win that's embarrassing Trump. One win is a really big win. Let's talk about what the really big win might be. Let's talk about why all this time, money, and effort is being done. Let's talk about why 15 million American voters, the progressives who don't care about them to begin with, want to disenfranchise their votes so that they had no voice in this election whatsoever. The Constitution, many of the pundits believe, requires if no candidate gets 270 electoral votes, they believe the Constitution allows the House of Representatives to select a president. I disagree, respectfully. I believe that the Constitution calls for the House of Representatives to certify an electoral vote. If it is 270 electoral votes, they are certifying only the 270 minimum electoral votes necessary to proclaim Joe or Sally president. If it is less than 270 votes, then he or she who has the majority of the electoral votes that have been cast is the president, and the House has only the power to ratify that majority. Think carefully about what I am saying. So if Wisconsin, with 10 votes, and Michigan, with 16 votes, and Pennsylvania, with 18 votes, could not send electors to the Electoral College because their votes have not been certified, because of all the shenanigans on the recount and the time, there just isn't enough time to do it, then Trump's 306, and bear with me, I'm going to round numbers. Trump's 306 current electoral votes goes down by 44 electoral votes. Kind of interesting. That puts him at below 270. And you go, oh, well, that's okay because he still has the majority, right? I mean, he's at 265 or whatever he's at, 264, and Hillary's at 232 or 238 or whatever hell she's at, and he still has the majority. Well, now, let's tie this into this other dot that I talked about last week, and that is, and it's, this has been reported on the mainstream media, that is all these death threats, all this haranguing, all this arm twisting that's going on across the country by progressives, and I think some Republican never-Trumpers, and I've told you what I think of those folks, for electors to either not vote or to cast their vote for Hillary or to not cast their vote for Trump. And I reported to you 2 weeks ago when this all started that 37 Republican electors would have to become faithless electors, in other words, not vote for Trump, even though their state voted for Trump, for that to work. Well, you know, if Trump is reduced because these other three states don't go to the Electoral College, to 265, again, rounding votes, and Hillary is at, and once again, I'm going to round votes, even though every vote would be critical in this case. I'm trying to get the big picture across to you, not the specifics of the numbers of votes. And Hillary was at 235. Gee, they wouldn't have to get 37 Republicans to switch their votes, would they? Now they're down to 30. Throw in some Democratic stuff, et cetera, et cetera. Throw in a couple of electors that are going to be faithless electors and not vote for Trump or Hillary. They're going to write in John McCain or the man on the moon or who knows what they're going to do. And you're 20. Again, round numbers and surmising. And suddenly, even though it's an outside straight, you do have the potential of no candidate reaching 270 electoral votes, and by a combination of faithless electors and Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan not sending electors to the Electoral College because of this recount shenanigans, you have the possibility, outside straight as it may be, that Hillary Clinton could actually wind up somewhere around 235 electoral votes, and Donald Trump could wind up at somewhere around 230 or 232 electoral votes. In other words, Hillary Clinton would have the majority of the electoral votes cast. And folks, if my interpretation of the Constitution, I don't hold myself out to be any scholar, I just read the English language. If my interpretation of the Constitution is correct, the House can't do anything about it but certify Hillary Clinton as president because she has the majority of electoral votes in this scenario I just painted for you. And I think, personally, that that's what the Democrats are shooting for. I really do. And if they fall short, then they accomplish their other more minor wins. One of these days, we're going to talk about how we not get in this position again. Otherwise, we're going to be facing it every election from the left, who on the one hand bristles and decries Trump, saying, I'm not telling you anything right now until I see the results. Then I'll let you know if, you know, whether I agree with him or not. who waits 3 weeks. In other words, they let time lapse. That's another point I forgot to bring up. These recounts weren't started the day after the vote. They weren't started 3 days after the vote when the votes were really kind of well known, not just election night. They were started 3 weeks after the vote. The very end of November, with Thanksgiving interfering, and just 2 or 3 weeks ahead of the Electoral College. There's a reason for that, folks. Nothing happens in a vacuum, and there are no coincidences. Now, I am once again way over my time. I'm going to be stretched and tortured and who knows what by the AM stations. And once again, you folks who are getting cut off early by AM, sorry about that. Go to www.ontherightsideradio.com. You can listen to the rest of the show. As my very last segment, I'm going to do this very quickly since I'm over time. So, there was a device. It was being transported from an Iranian nuclear facility. It had iridium-192. The facility is the Bushehr, B-U-S-H-E-H-R, nuclear power plant. The truck carrying it was hijacked. We don't have details, don't know if the drivers were killed, whatever, but it cannot be found, nor can this container of iridium. And somehow, you know, the Iranians, since we don't have inspection capabilities on the Iranian deal, are being very closed-mouthed about how much was actually hijacked and by whom. Or maybe Iran was complicit. Who knows? This is perfect material, folks, for somebody who wants to make a dirty bomb. Perfect. Okay? The identity of the thief is unknown. And, of course, according to Iranian state radio, the purpose for which the device was stolen, or whether the thief is even aware of what he or she stole, is unknown. Yes, you bet. Absolutely. By the way, iridium-192 is defined by the IAEA, that's the International Atomic Energy Agency, highly unstable isotope which emits both electrons and gamma rays, as a Category 2 radioactive substance. It is used primarily to locate structural flaws in metals. Substances with a Category 2 classification can permanently injure or kill a human being exposed to the material within hours. Now, what's kind of interesting, the theft was reported to the IAEA in the first part of November. The IAEA warned the states surrounding Iran, but you know, somehow, even though the American press got the warning and it was up there in the world's radar screen, we didn't hear squat about it. I wonder why that is. Maybe we should ask Barry. Maybe we should ask Barry. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. I may be wrong. I think it's an outside street. I think the odds are against it. But I want you to think about the dots I gave you on this recount stuff. And I want you to understand how they all connect. Obama, Muslims, radical Islam, globalism, money, Hillary Clinton, Jill Stein, George Soros, waiting 3 weeks, demanding hand recounts which take more time, throwing in lawsuits which take more time. Understand how it works. And let's keep our fingers crossed, shall we? Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Hope to see lots of you at book signings. We'll talk to you next week.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.